Feel like your skin isn't reflecting how young you truly feel? It's time for a breakthrough. Introducing Hydrotherapy Wrinkle Reducer, a dermatologist-recommended formula powered by Renovage and Matrixyl 3000. This powerful yet gentle solution visibly reduces fine lines and deep wrinkles up to 68% without the harsh effects of retinol. It's safe for sensitive skin and perfect for everyday use. Real users are seeing smoother, firmer, more radiant skin, often in just weeks. No irritation, no guessing, just real, proven results. Visit hydrotherapylove.com now and start your journey to younger-looking skin today. That's hydrotherapylove.com, because your skin deserves expert care.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's one thing to claim innocence, but quite another when physical evidence seems to directly contradict that claim. Imagine you're driving along, minding your own business, and suddenly your car is tied to someone's death by something as tiny and invisible as a trace of DNA. That's exactly what happened this week when the DNA analyst Nicholas Bradford took the stand in the Karen Reed trial, calmly dropped a forensic bombshell, and turned the Karen Reed murder trial from a complicated legal puzzle into a laser-focused debate on microscopic details. We got a lot to talk about today of what occurred in the trial of Karen Reed on day number 18. There's a lot to cover here, from that DNA to the timeline to old LinkedIn profile. It's all there. Let me know in the comments what you think about all of this on YouTube or X, Twitter, wherever you may be following us. Be sure to press subscribe as well, whether it's the podcast platform or one of the video platforms or social platforms. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this. And of course, we're always wanting to hear your opinion. Bradford works for Bode Technology, the kind of lab that sounds like something out of a high-budget Netflix series. Bode Technology. We're here when no one else is, and we're watching. Okay, that's not what it is. It's not like Resident Evil. It's all crisp white coats and sleek equipment, right? Where small biological samples speak louder than any witness ever could. He explained to the jury that when investigators examined Karen Reed's black Lexus SUV, they found something intriguing on a shattered fragment of the vehicle's taillight. It wasn't just glass or plastic shards they were looking at. It was DNA. Tiny molecules holding massive implications. According to Bradford, this wasn't just any random DNA. It matched John O'Keefe's, the victim, the Boston police officer Karen Reed allegedly struck with her car. Shocking, right? It was strong, compelling evidence. Bradford mentioned a DNA mixture involving at least three people, one definitely male, but most critically, he confirmed that the probability of the DNA belonging to O'Keefe was overwhelming. Picture it like this. Bradford had essentially fingerprinted O'Keefe's biology onto Karen's SUV. For prosecutors, it was a home run. The type of forensic evidence most cases dream about. But here's the thing with forensic evidence. It's rarely that straightforward. For every piece of DNA pointing directly at one scenario, there's room to question, poke holes, and raise doubt. And that's exactly what Karen Reed's defense team jumped on. Defense attorney Alan Jackson took to cross-examining Bradford with the determination of someone peeling back layers of an onion, each question sharper and more pointed than the last. He wasn't denying that DNA existed or belonged to John O'Keefe. Instead, Jackson was asking, who else did you test? And more importantly, who didn't you test? Turns out investigators hadn't taken DNA samples from several other potentially critical players. Brian Elbert, whose home O'Keefe was found outside of, Kevin Elbert, Brian's brother and a detective himself, Brian Higgins, an ATF agent with connections to Reed, and Ken Berkowitz, who at the time was the Canton police chief, none of which had been struck by a vehicle. So unless they're out there rubbing their heads against Karen's taillight, I don't know. Why would you? These aren't random names plucked out of thin air. These are individuals closely tied to the scene, to the case, and possibly, according to the defense, to the mystery of John O'Keefe's death. Because, yes, they all went out there and rubbed their heads against her taillight. Now, imagine you're a juror. You've just heard compelling testimony that links the victim directly to the accused vehicle. Sounds cut and dry, but suddenly you're hearing that investigators may have left significant stones unturned. It's a bit like detectives proudly showing you a finished puzzle only to have the defense reveal they never checked under the couch for missing pieces, even though you finished the entire puzzle and there's no more pieces to put together. But did you find more of those missing pieces underneath the couch? Well, the puzzle's complete over here. There wouldn't be any more pieces. Maybe they're pieces to another puzzle. I mean, there's stuff that you can find under couches. I mean, if you just looked at it and didn't realize the puzzle was complete over here, you may go, I wonder if it's from that puzzle. But then you look at the puzzle and it's complete. You don't need other pieces. But there's more puzzle pieces under the couch. You're right, there may be. But it ain't from this puzzle. Could those untested DNA samples have belonged to someone else? Could the presence of another person's DNA have suggested a completely different story? I don't know what that story would be. We beat him up, then we rubbed our heads against Karen's taillight that's broken, all in an effort to frame her, or I don't even know where the story would go because it doesn't make any sense. Nor does it seem to introduce reasonable doubt. It just seems to be a lot of words that they're hoping the jury will think is actually meaningful. Bradford acknowledged this under intense questioning. He calmly explained that while DNA from two state police officers, Trooper Michael Proctor and Yuri Bukenik, was tested for contamination and largely ruled out, he had not been asked to test samples from others who might reasonably have left traces. Bradford, the meticulous scientist, admitted he never explicitly excluded those possibilities because he wasn't asked to pursue them. Because it makes no sense! The defense launched into this omission, highlighting that absence of evidence is not necessarily evidence of absence. The defense also drew attention to Bradford's careful wording. When Bradford spoke of the trooper's DNA, he used terms like strong support for exclusion and acknowledged he could not visually exclude them initially. The defense zeroed in here, underscoring that exclusion in DNA forensics isn't absolute, it's statistical. It's probabilities and numbers, not black and white certainties. Alan Jackson skillfully did use Bradford's own careful phrasing against him, making sure jurors understood that forensic science isn't foolproof. It's just 99.99999999.012% foolproof. Which, you know, basically means it's foolproof. Despite how convincing it might seem at first glance, this moment did matter deeply because DNA evidence isn't just about linking a person to a crime scene. It's about eliminating doubts by drawing attention to the fact that multiple critical figures in the investigation weren't tested because there'd be no reasonable reason to test them. The defense planted seeds of uncertainty. They didn't need jurors to outright reject the prosecution's DNA evidence. They simply needed jurors to wonder, to question, and to doubt whether the investigators had truly covered every angle, even the unreasonable ones. Why didn't they test just random people that live on the street? I guess they could be there too. Maybe. I don't know. Because reasonable doubt, after all, is the magic phrase every defense attorney hopes to leave echoing in jurors' minds. And in this case, my God, they're shooting for that. And so as Bradford left the witness stand, jurors faced a decision. On one side, there's powerful forensic evidence tying the victim directly to Karen Reed's vehicle, evidence that seems to shout guilt. On the other, there's a nagging concern by some about investigative thoroughness or just random nonsense. It's as if jurors were given a map that clearly marks the path from Reed's SUV straight to O'Keefe's tragic end. But suddenly the defense points to an entire different map and different territories never explored because they're not on the path. And their hope is that they're going to leave them wondering if crucial information could be hidden just beyond the map's edges. You never know what's on the other side. Well, yeah, because that's not the direction I'm going. I'm not even looking there because it's not remotely part of this case. It's a forensic tug of war, with each side pulling jurors' trust back and forth. The DNA is undeniable, tangible evidence, but can jurors fully trust its interpretation if crucial questions remain unanswered? Bradford's testimony, with all its scientific certainty and cautious limitations, left jurors precisely in this, you know, kind of uncomfortable, thoughtful middle ground. Or at least that's what the defense sure hopes they left them as. As jurors mulled this over, the trial pivoted to yet another form of evidence, equally compelling and contentious, the digital forensic timeline that might finally reveal exactly when Karen Reed's SUV allegedly struck John O'Keefe. Of course, not without a lot of fog introduced. Not fog that naturally occurs, but fog from a fog machine that they basically brought in and said, here, it's foggy, it's natural, it's the environment, it's hot and it's cold, and fog has naturally occurred in this courtroom. Never mind that it smells like the stuff from haunted houses, slightly sweet, and not quite like real smoke or fog. And with that, a new layer of complexity awaited, ready to be unraveled. As jurors grappled with the nuances of the DNA evidence, prosecutors shifted their attention to another crucial component, the digital timeline. If DNA was the fingerprint linking Karen Reed's vehicle to the victim, the digital evidence was the stopwatch ticking down to the precise moment of tragedy. And that's exactly where digital forensic expert Shannon Burgess stepped into the spotlight. Burgess, with the meticulous patience you'd expect from someone who spends their days decoding digital breadcrumbs, presented an analysis of data from Karen Reed's SUV. According to him, the Lexus had logged a backing up maneuver at an eerily specific moment, precisely when John O'Keefe's phone stopped recording activity. Burgess explained it simply. Every car today is essentially a rolling computer tracking every little action from ignition to braking to reversing to when you pull that mirror down and the light comes on. And every smartphone, of course, is even more intrusive, logging each tap, step, or pause. Matching the data from those two devices, Burgess stated confidently, showed the SUV moving backwards at the exact instant O'Keefe's phone was manually locked, never to be unlocked again. This synchronization of vehicle and phone data wasn't trivial. It was potentially explosive evidence, and if accurate, it firmly placed Reed's car at the critical juncture, aligning perfectly with the prosecution's argument that Reed's vehicle fatally struck O'Keefe at the very moment. To illustrate this clearly, picture two separate clocks running on different devices, one in Karen's Lexus, another on John's phone. Burgess's job was essentially syncing these two clocks, adjusting them like a technician, revealing a synchronized narrative, a narrative that strongly favored the prosecution. But digital timelines are tricky. They require absolute precision, and even the smallest errors can ripple outward, turning solid evidence into questionable conjecture. But at the same point, think about this. The vehicle shows a strike, even if his timeline is slightly off. where and why did that strike occur? Considering you have a dead man and a broken taillight on the side of the road. One may put those together and go, this seems to connect the dots. But even more scientifically proven when the dots match up exactly. Burgess himself conceded this fact, noting slight discrepancies between the clocks. The SUV's internal system lagged about 20-some seconds behind real time when compared to O'Keefe's phone data. It was a minor correction in his view, but those seconds could mean everything in a trial where timelines matter immensely. Recognizing that, the defense didn't hesitate. Defense attorney Robert Alessi jumped immediately into an aggressive cross-examination. His approach was sharp and methodical, aimed at unraveling not just Burgess's data, but his very credibility. And Alessi quickly found his angle. It turned out Burgess had a glaring inconsistency in his professional history. Under oath, Burgess admitted that his official documents and online professional profiles incorrectly claimed he had completed a bachelor's degree, when in reality he hadn't. Burgess attempted to explain, called it a clerical mistake or oversight, but Alessi was having none of it. It must mean everything's a lie. Everything you say, we can't believe it. All the data is false because your LinkedIn profile hasn't been updated in years. Oh, wait, neither has yours. Or Garen's. Or most people. With each claim yet incisive of questions, Alessi amplified the notion that if Burgess couldn't accurately represent himself, jurors might reasonably question his accuracy interpreting complex digital evidence. Maybe he can't even get out of bed in the morning. How does he know to turn the key in his car? Or maybe you have to press a button or turn a dial. How does he know to eat? How could he possibly care for himself? He should probably be in a padded room because that LinkedIn profile is not accurate. The courtroom watched closely, recognizing that expert testimony hinges as much on trust as it does on technical details. After all, forensic data isn't self-explanatory. It demands interpretation, and interpretation relies heavily on experts' integrity. By undermining Burgess's reliability, Alessi sought to undermine the entire foundation of the prosecution's digital timeline evidence. But the defense wasn't finished. They turned their focus next to conflicts between Burgess's testimony and earlier reports presented by another digital analyst, Ian Whiffen. According to Whiffen's findings, O'Keefe's phone continued recording movement, specifically 36 steps, covering roughly 84 feet, several seconds after the alleged moment of impact defined by Burgess. This significance of the discrepancy cannot be overstated. If Whiffen's data was accurate, it could indicate that O'Keefe, or at least his phone, continued moving slightly after the supposed collision. This posed a serious contradiction when Alessi highlighted vividly for the jurors. His argument was clear. How could O'Keefe's phone be registering steps after the prosecution claimed he'd been fatally incapacitated? Burgess, on the defensive now, carefully explained that discrepancies could exist due to slight variations between device clocks, data synchronization errors, or even delayed registrations within the phone's pedometer. He maintained that the core timeline remained valid, but the damage, at least from the defense's perspective, was already done. The mere suggestion that Burgess selectively interpreted data to bolster the prosecution's case was exactly the seed of reasonable doubt Alessi hoped to plant firmly in the jury's mind. Did it, though? It wasn't just the defense, though, who understood the importance of these digital discrepancies. Judge Cannone had a crucial role, too. Faced with defense objections, she carefully considered whether Burgess's controversial testimony should even be allowed. Her decision was clear. Burgess could testify, but she granted the defense substantial leeway in their questioning, explicitly allowing them to probe Burgess's credibility in depth. It was a significant ruling. By permitting the jury to hear Burgess while simultaneously encouraging rigorous scrutiny, Judge Cannone shaped the courtroom's dynamics significantly, indirectly signaling to jurors that credibility mattered deeply. And it does. And I question the prosecution. Why? Why is this your guy? Granted, it doesn't change the data, but could we find somebody who maybe had didn't pad their resume? Maybe we should look into that a little bit before we put somebody on the stand. Maybe find somebody who really, there ain't nothing you're going to do to this guy in terms of his credibility. I mean, granted, the defense is doing their job without a doubt. So good for them for doing their job. But if you notice, they didn't question anything about the timeline. Because at the end of the day, who's ever really going through this data? It's data. Whether you said you got a bachelor's degree on LinkedIn or not. For jurors, the decision was far more than a procedural footnote. It sent a message loud and clear that digital evidence, while compelling, wasn't immune from challenges, although there's really no challenge to the data. It was just more of his LinkedIn profile. Alessi's cross-examination underscored that reliability and expert testimony isn't automatic or guaranteed. It requires transparency, honesty, and precise consistency, qualities the defense argued Burgess lacked, given his credential inconsistencies and the timing of his analysis. Adding fuel to this fire, the defense questioned why Burgess' detailed timeline report appeared late in the trial. They pointed out that he had earlier access to relevant phone data months before he completed his analysis. Why, they wondered openly, was this precise alignment introduced suddenly mid-trial rather than from the onset? Fair question. Alessi suggested subtly but powerfully that perhaps the prosecution was shifting gears, adjusting its case to new problems emerged, implying a reactive rather than proactive investigative process. In response, prosecutors maintained their stance that data and the delay wasn't tactical but simply procedural, a natural outcome of how forensic data is analyzed and validated. Sometimes it does take time. Yet the mere implication from the defense hanging over the courtroom could be enough to sway jurors toward skepticism. And again, that's the goal of the defense. That's, you want reasonable doubt. They're trying to plant the seeds. When Burgess finally stepped down from the stand, the courtroom had changed. Jurors who might have initially viewed digital data as clean, indisputable fact now had reason to maybe reconsider. Alessi had masterfully illuminated the shadows, areas of ambiguity, human error, and professional misrepresentation, showing jurors that forensic timelines, no matter how precise they appear, are still interpretations influenced by human judgment and potential error, without even talking about the timeline. He said nothing about the timeline. It was strictly all about how this man talked about a bachelor's degree from years ago. But reasonable doubt it is. That's why you got to be careful with who you put on the stand and where those holes are going to be poked. Jurors now faced a much more complex question. Digital timelines are supposed to clarify, simplify, and pinpoint exactly what happened. But what if those timelines become battlegrounds themselves, where precision is questioned and expertise is tainted by personal errors? This is no longer merely about seconds or timestamps. It was about trust, integrity, and the reliability of evidence itself. At the digital debate, and as it concluded, jurors found themselves confronted by compelling narratives, each strongly supported by detailed yet conflicting analyses. And just when they thought the courtroom tensions had reached their peak, yet another facet of this case waited quietly in the wings, ready to demand their attention, pushing the trial deeper into complexities that had yet to be unraveled. What do you think about all of this? Tell me in the comments section on YouTube or X, Twitter, wherever you may be watching this. If you're listening to the podcast, go check out our social media pages. Go check out YouTube, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, so you can comment and join that conversation, as cliche as that phrase is. And press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many that we are covering for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. My name is Tony Bruschi, and you know what? We'll talk again real soon, okay?
Want true crime coverage all day? every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.